objects of sense. Thus, in the case of two drops of water, we may make complete abstraction of all internal difference, quality and quantity, and the fact that they are intuited at the same time in different places is sufficient to justify us in holding them to be numerically different. Leibniz regarded phenomena as things in themselves, consequently as intelligibilia, that is, objects of pure understanding, although on account of the confused nature of their representations, he gave them the name of phenomena, and in this case his principle of the indiscernible, Principium identitatis indiscernibilium, is not to be impugned. But as phenomena are objects of sensibility, and as the understanding in respect of them must be employed empirically and not purely or transcendentally, plurality and numerical difference are given by space itself as the condition of external phenomena. For one part of space, although it may be perfectly similar and equal to another part, is still without it, and for this reason alone is different from the latter, which is added to it in order to make up a greater space. It follows that this must hold good of all things that are in the different parts of space at the same time, however similar and equal one may be to another. 2. Agreement and opposition. When reality is represented by the pure understanding, realitas noumenon, opposition between realities is incogitable. Such a relation, that is, that when these realities are connected in one subject, they annihilate the effects of each other and may be represented in the formula 3 minus 3 equals 0. On the other hand, the real in a phenomenon, realitas phenomenon, may very well be in mutual opposition, and when united in the same subject, the one may completely or in part annihilate the effect or consequence of the other, as in the case of two moving forces in the same straight line drawing or impelling a point in opposite directions, or in the case of a pleasure counterbalancing a certain amount of pain. 3. The internal and external. In an object of the pure understanding, only that is internal which has no relation, as regards its existence, to anything different from itself. On the other hand, the internal determinations of a substantia phenomenon in space are nothing but relations, and it is itself nothing more than a complex of mere relations. Substance in space we are cognizant of only through forces operative in it, either drawing others towards itself, attraction, or preventing others from forcing into itself, repulsion and impenetrability. We know no other properties that make up the conception of substance phenomenal in space, and which we term matter. On the other hand, as an object of the pure understanding, every substance must have internal determination and forces. But what other internal attributes of such an object can I think than those which my internal sense presents to me? That, to wit, which in either itself thought, or something analogous to it. Hence Leibniz, who looked upon things as noumena, after denying them everything like external relation, and therefore also composition or combination, declared that all substances, even the component parts of matter, were simple substances with powers of representation, in one word, monads. 4. Matter and form. These two conceptions lie at the foundation of all other reflection, so inseparably are they connected with every mode of exercising the understanding. The former denotes the determinable in general, the second its determination, both in a transcendental sense, abstraction being made of every difference in that which is given, and of the mode in which it is determined. Logicians formerly termed the universal matter, the specific difference of this or that part of the universal form. In a judgment one may call the given conceptions logical matter, for the judgment, the relation of these to each other, by means of the copula, the form of the judgment. In an object, the composite parts thereof, essentialia, are the matter, the mode in which they are connected in the object, the form. In respect to things in general, unlimited reality was regarded as the matter of all possibility, the limitation thereof, negation, as the form, by which one thing is distinguished from another according to transcendental conceptions. The understanding demands that something be given, at least in the conception, in order to be able to determine it in a certain manner. Hence, in a conception of the pure understanding, the matter precedes the form, and for this reason Leibniz first assumed the existence of things, monads, and of an internal power of representation in them, in order to found upon this their external relation and the community of their state, that is, of their representations. Hence, with him, space and time were possible, the former through the relation of substances, the latter through the connection of their determinations with each other as causes and effects. And so would it really be if the pure understanding were capable of an immediate application to objects, and if space and time were determinations of things in themselves. But being merely sensuous intuitions, in which we determine all objects solely as phenomena, the form of intuition, as a subjective property of sensibility, must antecede all matter, sensations. Consequently, space and time must antecede all phenomena and all data of experience, and rather make experience itself possible. But the intellectual philosopher could not endure that the form should precede the things themselves and determine their possibility. An objection perfectly correct if we assume that we intuit things as they are, although with confused representation. But as sensuous intuition is a peculiar subjective condition which is a priori at the foundation of all perception, and the form of which is primitive, the form must be given per se, and so far from the matter, or the things themselves which appear, lying at the foundation of experience, as we must conclude if we judge by mere conceptions. The very possibility of itself presupposes, on the contrary, a given formal intuition, space and time. Remark on the amphiboly of the conceptions of reflection. Let me be allowed to term the position which we assign to a conception either in the sensibility or in the pure understanding the transcendental place. In this manner, the appointment of the position which must be taken by each conception according to the difference in its use, and the directions for determining this place to all conceptions according to rules, would be a transcendental topic, a doctrine which would thoroughly shield us from the surreptitious devices of the pure understanding and the delusions which thence arise, as it would always distinguish to what faculty of each cognition each conception properly belonged. Every conception, every title under which many cognitions rank together, may be called a logical place. Upon this is based the logical topic of Aristotle, of which teachers and rhetoricians should avail themselves in order, under certain titles of thought, to observe what would best suit the matter they had to treat, and thus enable themselves to quibble and talk with fluency and an appearance of profundity. Transcendental topic, on the contrary, contains nothing more than the above-mentioned four titles of all comparison and distinction, which differ from categories in this respect, that they do not represent the object according to that which constitutes its conception, quantity, reality, but set forth merely the comparison of representations, which precedes our conceptions of things. But this comparison requires a previous reflection. That is, a determination of the place to which the representations of the things which are compared belong, whether to wit they are cogitated by the pure understanding or given by sensibility. Conceptions may be logically compared without the trouble of inquiring to what faculty their objects belong, whether as noumena to the understanding or as phenomena to sensibility. If, however, we wish to employ these conceptions in respect of objects, previous transcendental reflection is necessary. Without this reflection, I should make a very unsafe use of these conceptions, and construct pretended synthetical propositions which critical reason cannot acknowledge, and which are based solely upon a transcendental amphiboly, that is, upon a substitution of an object of pure understanding for a phenomenon. For want of this doctrine of transcendental topic, and consequently deceived by the amphiboly of the conceptions of reflection, the celebrated Leibniz constructed an intellectual system of the world, or rather, believed himself competent to cognize the internal nature of things, by comparing all objects merely with the understanding and the abstract formal conceptions of thought. Our table of the conceptions of reflection gives us the unexpected advantage of being able to exhibit the distinctive peculiarities of his system in all its parts, and at the same time of exposing the fundamental principle of this peculiar mode of thought, which rested upon naught but a misconception. He compared all things with each other merely by means of conceptions, and naturally found no other differences than those by which the understanding distinguishes its pure conceptions one from another. The conditions of sensuous intuition, which contain in themselves their own means of distinction, he did not look upon as primitive, because sensibility was to him but a confused mode of representation, and not any particular source of representations. A phenomenon was for him the representation of the thing in itself, although distinguished from cognition by the understanding only in respect of the logical form, the former with its usual want of analysis containing, according to him, a certain mixture of collateral representations in its conception of a thing which it is the duty of the understanding to separate and distinguish. In one word, Leibniz intellectualized phenomena, just as Locke, in his system of nougany, if I may be allowed to make use of such expressions, sensualized the conceptions of the understanding, that is to say, declared them to be nothing more than empirical or abstract conceptions of reflection. Instead of seeking in the understanding and sensibility two different sources of representations, which, however, can present us with objective judgments of things only in conjunction, each of these great men recognized but one of these faculties, which, in their opinion, applied immediately to things in themselves, the other having no duty but that of confusing or arranging the representations of the former. Accordingly, the objects of sense were compared by Leibniz as things in general merely in the understanding. First, he compares them in regard to their identity or difference, as judged by the understanding. As, therefore, he considered merely the conceptions of objects, and not their position in intuition, in which alone objects can be given, and left quite out of sight the transcendental locale of these conceptions, whether that is their object ought to be classed among phenomena or among things in themselves, it was to be expected that he should extend the application of the principle of indiscernibles, which is valid solely of conceptions of things in general, to objects of sense, mundus phenomenon, and that he should believe that he had thereby contributed in no small degree to extend our knowledge of nature. In truth, if I cognize in all its inner determinations a drop of water as a thing in itself, I cannot look upon one drop as different from another, if the conception of the one is completely identical with that of the other. But if it is a phenomenon in space, it has a place not merely in the understanding, among conceptions, but also in sensuous external intuition, in space. And in this case, the physical locale is a matter of indifference in regard to the internal determinations of things, and one place, B, may contain a thing which is perfectly similar and equal to another in a place A, just as well as if the two things were in every respect different from each other. Difference of place without any other conditions makes the plurality and distinction of objects as phenomena not only possible in itself, but even necessary. Consequently, the above so-called law is not a law of nature. It is merely an analytical rule for the comparison of things by means of mere conceptions. Second, the principle realities, as simple affirmations, never logically contradict each other, is a proposition perfectly true respecting the relation of conceptions, but whether as regards nature or things in themselves, of which we have not the slightest conception, is without any the least meaning. For real opposition, in which A minus B is zero, exists everywhere, an opposition, that is, in which one reality united with another in the same subject annihilates the effects of the other, a fact which is constantly brought before our eyes by the different antagonistic actions and operations in nature, which nevertheless, as depending on real forces, must be called realitatis phenomena. General mechanics can even present us with the empirical condition of this opposition in an a priori rule, as it directs its attention to the opposition in the direction of forces, a condition of which the transcendental conception of reality can tell us nothing. Although Mr. Leibniz did not announce this proposition with precisely the pomp of a new principle, he yet employed it for the establishment of new propositions, and his followers introduced it into their Leibnizio-Wolfian system of philosophy. According to this principle, for example, all evils are but consequences of the limited nature of created beings, That is, negations, because these are the only opposite of reality. In the mere conception of a thing in general, this is really the case, but not in things as phenomena. In like manner, the upholders of this system deem it not only possible, but natural also, to connect and unite all reality in one being, because they acknowledge no other sort of opposition than that of contradiction, by which the conception itself of a thing is annihilated, and find themselves unable to conceive an opposition of reciprocal destruction, so to speak, in which one real cause destroys the effect of another, and the conditions of whose representation we meet with only in sensibility. Third, the Leibnizian monadology has really no better foundation than on this philosopher's mode of falsely representing the difference of the internal and external solely in relation to the understanding. Substances, in general, must have something inward, which is therefore free from external relations, consequently from that of composition also. The simple, that which can be represented by a unit, is therefore the foundation of that which is internal in things in themselves. The internal state of substances cannot therefore consist in place, shape, contact, or motion, determinations which are all external relations, and we can ascribe to them no other than that whereby we internally determine our faculty of sense itself, that is to say, the state of representation. Thus, then, were constructed the monads, which were to form the elements of the universe, the active force of which consists in representation, the effects of this force being thus entirely confined to themselves. For the same reason, his view of the possible community of substances could not represent it but as a predetermined harmony, and by no means as a physical influence. For inasmuch as everything is occupied only internally, that is, with its own representations, the state of the representations of one substance could not stand in active and living connection with that of another, but some third cause operating on all without exception was necessary to make the different states correspond with one another. And this did not happen by means of assistance applied in each particular case, systema assistentiae, but through the unity of the idea of a cause occupied and connected with all substances, in which they necessarily receive, according to the Leibnizian school, their existence and permanence, consequently also reciprocal correspondence, according to universal laws. Fourth, this philosopher's celebrated doctrine of space and time, in which he intellectualized these forms of sensibility, originated in the same delusion of transcendental reflection. If I attempt to represent by the mere understanding the external relations of things, I can do so only by employing the conception of their reciprocal action, and if I wish to connect one state of the same thing with another state, I must avail myself of the notion of the order of cause and effect. And thus Leibniz regarded space as certain order in the community of substances, and time as the dynamical sequence of their states. That which space and time possess proper to themselves and independent of things, he ascribed to a necessary confusion of our conceptions of them, whereby that which is a mere form of dynamical relations is held to be a self-existent intuition, antecedent even to things themselves. Thus, space and time were the intelligible form of the connection of things, substances and their states, in themselves. But things were intelligible substances, substantiae numina. At the same time, he made these conceptions valid of phenomena, because he did not allow to sensibility a peculiar mode of intuition, but sought all, even the empirical representation of objects in the understanding, and left to sense naught but the despicable task of confusing and disarranging the representations of the former. But even if we could frame any synthetical proposition concerning things in themselves by means of the pure understanding, which is impossible, it could not apply to phenomena which do not represent things in themselves. In such a case, I should be obliged in transcendental reflection to compare my conceptions only under the conditions of sensibility, and so space and time would not be determinations of things in themselves but of phenomena. What things may be in themselves, I know not and need not know, because a thing is never presented to me otherwise than as a phenomenon. I must adopt the same mode of procedure with the other conceptions of reflection. Matter is a substantia phenomenon. That in it which is internal I seek to discover in all parts of space which it occupies, and in all the functions and operations it performs, and which are indeed never anything but phenomena of the external sense. I cannot therefore find anything that is absolutely, but only what is comparatively internal, and which itself consists of external relations. The absolutely internal in matter, and as it should be according to the pure understanding, is a mere chimera, for matter is not an object for the pure understanding. But the transcendental object, which is the foundation of the phenomenon which we call matter, is a mere nisi quid, the nature of which we could not understand, even though someone were found able to tell us. For we can understand nothing that does not bring with it something in intuition corresponding to the expressions employed. If, by the complaint of being unable to perceive the internal nature of things, it is meant that we do not comprehend by the pure understanding what the things which appear to us may be in themselves, it is a silly and unreasonable complaint. For those who talk thus really desire that we should be able to cognize, consequently to intuit, things without senses, and therefore wish that we possessed a faculty of cognition perfectly different from the human faculty, not merely in degree, but even as regards intuition and the mode thereof, so that thus we should not be men, but belong to a class of beings, the possibility of whose existence, much less their nature and constitution, we have no means of cognizing. By observation and analysis of phenomena, we penetrate into the interior of nature, and no one can say what progress this knowledge may make in time. But those transcendental questions which pass beyond the limits of nature, we could never answer, even although all nature were laid open to us, because we have not the power of observing our own mind with any other intuition than that of our internal sense. For herein lies the mystery of the origin and source of our faculty of sensibility. Its application to an object and the transcendental ground of this unity of subjective and objective lie too deeply concealed for us who cognize ourselves only through the internal sense, consequently as phenomena, to be able to discover in our existence anything but phenomena, the non-sensuous cause of which we at the same time earnestly desire to penetrate to. The great utility of this critique of conclusions arrived at by the process of mere reflection consists in its clear demonstration of the nullity of all conclusions respecting objects which are compared with each other in the understanding alone, while it at the same time confirms what we particularly insisted on, namely, that although phenomena are not included as things in themselves among the objects of the pure understanding, they are nevertheless the only things by which our cognition can possess objective reality, that is to say, which give us intuitions to correspond with our conceptions. When we reflect in a purely logical manner, we do nothing more than compare conceptions in our understanding to discover whether both have the same content, whether they are self-contradictory or not, whether anything is contained in either conception, which of the two is given, and which is merely a mode of thinking that given. But if I apply these conceptions to an object in general, in a transcendental sense, without first determining whether it is an object of sensuous or intellectual intuition, certain limitations present themselves, which forbid us to pass beyond the conceptions and render all empirical use of them impossible. And thus these limitations prove that the representation of an object as a thing in general is not only insufficient, but, without sensuous determination and independently of empirical conditions, self-contradictory. That we must therefore make abstraction of all objects, as in logic, or admitting them, must think them under conditions of sensuous intuition. That consequently, the intelligible requires an altogether peculiar intuition which we do not possess, and in the absence of which it is for us nothing, while on the other hand, phenomena cannot be objects in themselves. For when I merely think things in general, the difference in their external relations cannot constitute a difference in the things themselves. On the contrary, the former presupposes the latter, and if the conception of one of two things is not internally different from that of the other, I am merely thinking the same thing in different relations. Further, by addition of one affirmation, reality, to the other, the positive therein is really augmented, and nothing is abstracted or withdrawn from it. Hence, the real in things cannot be in contradiction with or opposition to itself, and so on. The true use of the conceptions of reflection in the employment of the understanding has, as we have shown, been so misconceived by Leibniz, one of the most acute philosophers of either ancient or modern times, that he has been misled into the construction of a baseless system of intellectual cognition, which professes to determine its objects without the intervention of the senses. For this reason, the exposition of the cause of the amphiboly of these conceptions, as the origin of these false principles, is of great utility in determining with certainty the proper limits of the understanding. It is right to say whatever is affirmed or denied of the whole of a conception can be affirmed or denied of any part of it, dictum de omni et nullo. But it would be absurd so to alter this logical proposition as to say whatever is not contained in a general conception is likewise not contained in the particular conceptions which rank under it. For the latter are particular conceptions, for the very reason that their content is greater than that which is cogitated in the general conception. And yet, the whole intellectual system of Leibniz is based upon this false principle, and with it must necessarily fall to the ground, together with all the ambiguous principles in reference to the employment of the understanding which have thence originated. Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles or indistinguishables is really based on the presupposition that, if in the conception of a thing a certain distinction is not to be found, it is also not to be met with in things themselves, that consequently all things are completely identical, numero eadem, which are not distinguishable from each other, as to quality or quantity, in our conceptions of them. But as in the mere conception of anything, abstraction has been made of many necessary conditions of intuition, that of which abstraction has been made is rashly held to be non-existent, and nothing is attributed to the thing but what is contained in its conception. The conception of a cubic foot of space, however I may think it, is in itself completely identical. But two cubic feet in space are nevertheless distinct from each other from the sole fact of their being in different places. They are numero diversa. And these places are conditions of intuition, wherein the object of this conception is given, and which do not belong to the conception, but to the faculty of sensibility. In like manner, there is in the conception of a thing no contradiction when a negative is not connected with an affirmative. And merely affirmative conceptions cannot, in conjunction, produce any negation. But in sensuous intuition, wherein reality, take for example motion, is given, we find conditions, opposite directions, of which abstraction has been made in the conception of motion in general, which render possible a contradiction or opposition, not indeed of a logical kind, and which, from pure motives, produce 0 = 0. We are therefore not justified in saying that all reality is in perfect agreement and harmony, because no contradiction is discoverable among its conceptions. See footnote. According to mere conceptions, that which is internal is the substratum of all relations or external determinations. When, therefore, I abstract all conditions of intuition and confine myself solely to the conception of a thing in general, I can make abstraction of all external relations, and there must nevertheless remain a conception of that which indicates no relation but merely internal determinations. Now it seems to follow that in everything, substance, there is something which is absolutely internal and which antecedes all external determinations, inasmuch as it renders them possible, and that therefore this substratum is something which does not contain any external relations, and is consequently simple, for corporeal things are never anything but relations, at least of their parts external to each other, And inasmuch as we know of no other absolutely internal determinations than those of the internal sense, this substratum is not only simple, but also, analogously with the internal sense, determined through representations. That is to say, all things are properly monads, or simple beings endowed with the power of representation. Now, all this would be perfectly correct if the conception of a thing were the only necessary condition of the presentation of objects of external intuition. It is, on the contrary, manifest that a permanent phenomenon in space, impenetrable extension, can contain mere relations, and nothing that is absolutely internal, and yet be the primary substratum of all external perception. By mere conceptions, I cannot think anything external without at the same time thinking something internal, for the reason that conceptions of relations presuppose given things, and without these are impossible. But as an intuition there is something, that is space, which with all it contains consists of pure, formal, or indeed real relations, which is not found in the mere conception of a thing in general, and this presents to us the substratum which could not be cognized through conceptions alone. I cannot say, because a thing cannot be represented by mere conceptions without something absolutely internal, there is also, in the things themselves which are contained under these conceptions, and in their intuition, nothing external to which something absolutely internal does not serve as the foundation. For when we have made abstraction of all the conditions of intuition, there certainly remains in the mere conception nothing but the internal in general, through which alone the external is possible. But this necessity, which is grounded upon abstraction alone, does not obtain in the case of things themselves, in so far as they are given in intuition with such determinations as express mere relations, without having anything internal as their foundation. For they are not things in themselves, but only phenomena. What we cognize in matter is nothing but relations. What we call its internal determinations are but comparatively internal. But there are some self-subsistent and permanent through which a determined object is given. That I, when abstraction is made of these relations, have nothing more to think, does not destroy the conception of a thing as phenomenon, nor the conception of an object in abstracto, but it does away with the possibility of an object that is determinable according to mere conceptions, that is, of a noumenon. It is certainly startling to hear that a thing consists solely of relations, but this thing is simply a phenomenon, and cannot be cogitated by means of the mere categories. It does itself consist in the mere relation of something in general to the senses. In the same way, we cannot cogitate relations of things in abstracto if we commence with conceptions alone, in any other manner than that one is the cause of determinations in the other, for that is itself the conception of the understanding or category of relation. But as in this case we make abstraction of all intuition, we lose together the mode in which the manifold determines to each of its parts its place, that is, the form of sensibility, space, and yet this mode antecedes all empirical causality. Footnote. If anyone wishes here to have recourse to the usual subterfuge and to say that at least realitatis noumena cannot be in opposition to each other, it will be requisite for him to adduce an example of this pure and non-sensuous reality, that it may be understood whether the notion represents something or nothing. But an example cannot be found except in experience, which never presents to us anything more than phenomena. And thus the proposition means nothing more than that the conception which contains only affirmatives does not contain anything negative, a proposition nobody ever doubted. If by intelligible objects we understand things which can be thought by means of the pure categories without the need of the schemata of sensibility, such objects are impossible. For the condition of the objective use of all our conceptions of understanding is the mode of our sensuous intuition, whereby objects are given, and if we make abstraction of the latter, the former can have no relation to an object. And even if we should suppose a different kind of intuition from our own, still our functions of thought would have no use or signification in respect thereof. But if we understand by the term objects of a non-sensuous intuition, in respect of which our categories are not valid, and of which we can accordingly have no knowledge, neither intuition nor conception, in this merely negative sense noumena must be admitted. For this is no more than saying that our mode of intuition is not applicable to all things, but only to objects of our senses, that consequently its objective validity is limited, and that room is therefore left for another kind of intuition, and thus also for things that may be objects of it. But in this sense the conception of a noumenon is problematical, that is to say, it is the notion of a thing of which we can neither say that it is possible nor that it is impossible, inasmuch as we do not know of any mode of intuition besides the sensuous, or of any other sort of conceptions than the categories, a mode of intuition and a kind of conception neither of which is applicable to a non-sensuous object. We are on this account incompetent to extend the sphere of our objects of thought beyond the conditions of our sensibility, and to assume the existence of objects of pure thought, that is, of noumena, inasmuch as these have no true positive signification. For it must be confessed of the categories that they are not of themselves sufficient for the cognition of things in themselves, and, without the data of sensibility, are mere subjective forms of the unity of the understanding. Thought is certainly not a product of the senses, and in so far is not limited by them, but it does not therefore follow that it may be employed purely and without the intervention of sensibility, for it would then be without reference to an object. And we cannot call a noumenon an object of pure thought, for the representation thereof is but the problematical conception of an object for a perfectly different intuition and a perfectly different understanding from ours, both of which are consequently themselves problematical. The conception of a noumenon is therefore not the conception of an object, but merely a problematical conception inseparably connected with the limitation of our sensibility. That is to say, this conception contains the answer to the question, are there objects quite unconnected with and independent of our intuition? A question to which only an indeterminate answer can be given. That answer is, inasmuch as sensuous intuition does not apply to all things without distinction, there remains room for other and different objects. The existence of these problematical objects is therefore not absolutely denied, in the absence of a determinate conception of them. But, as no category is valid in respect of them, neither must they be admitted as objects for our understanding. Understanding accordingly limits sensibility, without at the same time enlarging its own field. While, moreover, it forbids sensibility to apply its form and modes to things in themselves and restricts it to the sphere of phenomena, it cogitates an object in itself only, however, as a transcendental object, which is the cause of a phenomenon, consequently not itself a phenomenon, and which cannot be thought either as a quantity or as reality, or as substance, because these conceptions always require sensuous forms in which to determine an object. An object, therefore, of which we are quite unable to say whether it can be met with in ourselves or out of us, whether it would be annihilated together with sensibility, or, if this were taken away, would continue to exist. If we wish to call this object a noumenon, because the representation of it is non-sensuous, we are at liberty to do so. But as we apply to it none of the conceptions of our understanding, the representation is for us quite void, and is available only for the indication of the limits of our sensuous intuition, thereby leaving at the same time an empty space which we are competent to fill by the aid neither of possible experience nor of the pure understanding. The critique of the pure understanding, accordingly, does not permit us to create for ourselves a new field of objects beyond those which are presented to us as phenomena, and to stray into intelligible words. Nay, it does not even allow us to endeavour to form so much as a conception of them. The specious error which leads to this, and which is a perfectly excusable one, lies in the fact that the employment of the understanding, contrary to its proper purpose and destination, is made transcendental, and objects, that is, possible intuitions, are made to regulate themselves according to conceptions, instead of the conceptions arranging themselves according to the intuitions, on which alone their own objective validity rests. Now the reason of this, again, is that apperception, and with it thought, antecedes all possible determinate arrangement of representations. Accordingly, we think something in general and determine it on the one hand sensuously, but on the other distinguish the general and in abstracto represented object from this particular mode of intuiting it. In this case, there remains a mode of determining the object by mere thought, which is really but a logical form without content, which, however, seems to us to be a mode of the existence of the object in itself, noumenon, without regard to intuition, which is limited to our senses. Before ending this transcendental analytic, we must make an addition, which, although in itself of no particular importance, seems to be necessary to the completeness of the system. The highest conception with which a transcendental philosophy commonly begins is the division into possible and impossible. But as all division presupposes a divided conception, a still higher one must exist, and this is the conception of an object in general, problematically understood and without its being decided whether it is something or nothing. As the categories are the only conceptions which apply to objects in general, the distinguishing of an object, whether it is something or nothing, must proceed according to the order and direction of the categories. 1. To the categories of quantity, that is, the conceptions of all, many, and one, the conception which annihilates all, that is, the conception of none, is opposed. And thus, the object of a conception, to which no intuition can be found to correspond, is equals nothing. That is, it is a conception without an object, ens rationis, like noumena, which cannot be considered possible in the sphere of reality, though they must not therefore be held to be impossible, or like certain new fundamental forces in matter, the existence of which is cogitable without contradiction, though, as examples from experience are not forthcoming, they must not be regarded as possible. 2. Reality is something. Negation is nothing, that is, a conception of the absence of an object, as cold, a shadow, nihil privativum. 3. The mere form of intuition without substance is in itself no object, but the merely formal condition of an object, as phenomenon, as pure space and pure time. These are certainly something, as forms of intuition, but are not themselves objects which are intuited, ens imaginarium. 4. The object of a conception which is self-contradictory is nothing, because the conception is nothing, is impossible as a figure composed of two straight lines, nihil negativum. The table of this division of the conception of nothing, the corresponding division of the conception of something, does not require special description, must therefore be arranged as follows. Nothing as, 1, as empty conception without object, ens rationis. 2, empty object of a conception, nihil privativum. 3, empty intuition without object, ens imaginarium. 4, empty object without conception, nihil negativum. We see that the ens rationis is distinguished from the nihil negativum, or pure nothing, by the consideration that the former must not be reckoned among possibilities, because it is a mere fiction, though not self-contradictory, while the latter is completely opposed to all possibility, inasmuch as the conception annihilates itself. Both, however, are empty conceptions. On the other hand, the nihil privativum and ens imaginarium are empty data for conceptions. If light be not given to the senses, we cannot represent to ourselves darkness, and if extended objects are not perceived, we cannot represent space. Neither the negation nor the mere form of intuition can, without something real, be an object. Transcendental Logic. Second Division. Transcendental Dialectic. Introduction. 1. Of Transcendental Illusory Appearance. We termed dialectic in general a logic of appearance. This does not signify a doctrine of probability, for probability is truth only cognized upon insufficient grounds, and though the information it gives us is imperfect, it is not therefore deceitful. Hence it must not be separated from the analytical part of logic. Still less must phenomenon and appearance be held to be identical. For truth or illusory appearance does not reside in the object insofar as it is intuited, but in the judgment upon the object insofar as it is thought. It is therefore quite correct to say that the senses do not err, not because they always judge correctly, but because they do not judge at all. Hence truth and error, consequently also illusory appearance as the cause of error, are only to be found in a judgment, that is, in the relation of an object to our understanding. In a cognition which completely harmonizes with the laws of the understanding, no error can exist. In a representation of the senses, as not containing any judgment, there is also no error. But no power of nature can of itself deviate from its own laws. Hence, neither the understanding per se, without the influence of another cause, nor the senses per se would fall into error. The former could not, because, if it acts only according to its own laws, the effect, the judgment, must necessarily accord with these laws. But in accordance with the laws of the understanding consists the formal element in all truth. In the senses there is no judgment, neither a true nor a false one. But, as we have no source of cognition besides these two, it follows that error is caused solely by the unobserved influence of the sensibility upon the understanding. And thus it happens that the subjective grounds of a judgment blend and are confounded with the objective, and cause them to deviate from their proper determination. See footnote. Just as a body in motion would always of itself proceed in a straight line, but if another impetus gives to it a different direction, it will then start off into a curvilinear line of motion. To distinguish the peculiar action of the understanding from the power which mingles with it, it is necessary to consider an erroneous judgment as the diagonal between two forces that determine the judgment in two different directions, which, as it were, form an angle, and to resolve this composite operation into the simple ones of the understanding and the sensibility. In pure a priori judgments, this must be done by means of transcendental reflection, whereby, as has been already shown, each representation has its place appointed in the corresponding faculty of cognition, and consequently the influence of the one faculty upon the other is made apparent. Footnote. Sensibility, subjected to the understanding as the object upon which the understanding employs its functions, is the source of real cognitions. But in so far as it exercises an influence upon the action of the understanding and determines it to judgment, sensibility is itself the cause of error. It is not at present our business to treat of empirical illusory appearance, for example, optical illusion, which occurs in the empirical application of otherwise correct rules of the understanding, and in which the judgment is misled by the influence of imagination. Our purpose is to speak of transcendental illusory appearance, which influences principles that are not even applied to experience, for in this case we should possess a sure test of their correctness, but which leads us, in disregard of all the warnings of criticism, completely beyond the empirical employment of the categories, and eludes us with the chimera of an extension of the sphere of the pure understanding. We shall term those principles, the application of which is confined entirely within the limits of possible experience, immanent. Those, on the other hand, which transgress these limits, we shall call transcendent principles. But by these latter I do not understand principles of the transcendental use or misuse of the categories, which is in reality a mere fault of the judgment when not under due restraint from criticism, and therefore not paying sufficient attention to the limits of the sphere in which the pure understanding is allowed to exercise its functions, but real principles which exhort us to break down all those barriers and to lay claim to a perfectly new field of cognition which recognizes no line of demarcation. Thus, transcendental and transcendent are not identical terms. The principles of the pure understanding, which we have already propounded, ought to be of empirical and not of transcendental use, that is, they are not applicable to any object beyond the sphere of experience. A principle which removes these limits, nay, which authorizes us to overstep them, is called transcendent. If our criticism can succeed in exposing the illusion in these pretended principles, those which are limited in their employment to the sphere of experience may be called, in opposition to the others, immanent principles of the pure understanding. Logical illusion, which consists merely in the imitations of the form of reason, the illusion in sophistical syllogisms, arises entirely from a want of due attention to logical rules. So soon as the attention is awakened to the case before us, this illusion totally disappears. Transcendental illusion, on the contrary, does not cease to exist, even after it has been exposed, and its nothingness clearly perceived by means of transcendental criticism. Take, for example, the illusion in the proposition, "The world must have a beginning in time." The cause of this is as follows. In our reason, subjectively considered as a faculty of human cognition, there exist fundamental rules and maxims of its exercise, which have completely the appearance of objective principles. Now, from this cause, it happens that the subjective necessity of a certain connection of our conceptions is regarded as an objective necessity of the determination of things in themselves. This illusion it is impossible to avoid, just as we cannot avoid perceiving that the sea appears to be higher at a distance than it is near the shore, because we see the former by means of higher rays than the latter, or, which is a still stronger case, as even the astronomer cannot prevent himself from seeing the moon larger at its rising than some time afterwards, although he is not deceived by this illusion. Transcendental dialectic will therefore content itself with exposing the illusory appearance in transcendental judgments and guarding us against it, but to make it, as in the case of logical illusion, entirely disappear and cease to be illusion is utterly beyond its power. For we have here to do with a natural and unavoidable illusion, which rests upon subjective principles, and imposes these upon us as objective, while logical dialectic, in the detection of sophisms, has to do merely with an error in the logical consequence of the propositions, or with an artificially constructed illusion in imitation of the natural error. There is, therefore, a natural and unavoidable dialectic of pure reason. Not that in which the bungler, from want of the requisite knowledge, involves himself, nor that which the sophist devises for the purpose of misleading, but that which is an inseparable adjunct of human reason, and which, even after its illusion have been exposed, does not cease to deceive and continually to lead reason into momentary errors, which it becomes necessary continually to remove. 2. Of pure reason as the seat of the transcendental illusory appearance. A. Of reason in general. All our knowledge begins with sense, proceeds thence to understanding, and ends with reason, beyond which nothing higher can be discovered in the human mind for elaborating the matter of intuition and subjecting it to the highest unity of thought. At this stage of our inquiry, it is my duty to give an explanation of this, the highest faculty of cognition, and I confess I find myself here in some difficulty. Of reason, as of the understanding, there is a merely formal, that is, logical use in which it makes abstraction of all content of cognition. But there is also a real use inasmuch as it contains in itself the source of certain conceptions and principles, which it does not borrow either from the senses or the understanding. The former faculty has been long defined by logicians as the faculty of mediate conclusion, in contradistinction to immediate conclusions, consequentiae immediate. But the nature of the latter, which itself generates conceptions, is not to be understood from this definition. Now, as a division of reason into a logical and a transcendental faculty presents itself here, it becomes necessary to seek for a higher conception of this source of cognition which shall comprehend both conceptions. In this we may expect, according to the analogy of the conceptions of the understanding, that the logical conception will give us the key to the transcendental, and that the table of the functions of the former will present us with the clue to the conceptions of reason. In the former part of our transcendental logic, we defined the understanding to be the faculty of rules. Reason may be distinguished from understanding as the faculty of principles. The term principle is ambiguous and commonly signifies merely a cognition that may be employed as a principle, although it is not in itself, and as regards its proper origin, entitled to the distinction. Every general proposition, even if derived from experience by the process of induction, may serve as the major in a syllogism, but it is not for that reason a principle. Mathematical axioms, for example, there can be only one straight line between two points, are general a priori cognitions and are therefore rightly denominated principles, relatively to the cases which can be subsumed under them. But I cannot for this reason say that I cognize this property of a straight line from principles. I cognize it only in pure intuition. Cognition from principles, then, is that cognition in which I cognize the particular in the general by means of conceptions. Thus, every syllogism is a form of the deduction of a cognition from a principle. For the major always gives a conception through which everything that is subsumed under the condition thereof is cognized according to a principle. Now, as every general cognition may serve as the major in a syllogism, and the understanding presents us with such general a priori propositions, they may be termed principles in respect of their possible use. But if we consider these principles of the pure understanding in relation to their origin, we shall find them to be anything rather than cognitions from conceptions. For they would not even be possible a priori if we could not rely on the assistance of pure intuition, in mathematics, or on that of the conditions of a possible experience. That everything that happens has a cause cannot be concluded from the general conception of that which happens. On the contrary, the principle of causality instructs us as to the mode of obtaining from that which happens a determinate empirical conception. Synthetical cognitions from conceptions the understanding cannot supply, and they alone are entitled to be called principles. At the same time, all general propositions may be termed comparative principles. It has been a long-cherished wish that, who knows how late, may one day be happily accomplished, that the principles of the endless variety of civil laws should be investigated and exposed. For in this way alone can we find the secret of simplifying legislation. But in this case, laws are nothing more than limitations of our freedom upon conditions under which it subsists in perfect harmony with itself. They consequently have for their object that which is completely our own work, and of which we ourselves may be the cause by means of these conceptions. But how objects as things in themselves, how the nature of things is subordinated to principles and is to be determined according to conceptions, is a question which it seems well nigh impossible to answer. Be this, however, as it may, for on this point our investigation is yet to be made, it is at least manifest from what we have said that cognition from principles is something very different from cognition by means of the understanding, which may indeed precede other cognitions in the form of a principle, but in itself, in so far as it is synthetical, is neither based upon mere thought nor contains a general proposition drawn from conceptions alone. The understanding may be a faculty for the production of unity of phenomena by virtue of rules. The reason is a faculty for the production of unity of rules of the understanding under principles. Reason, therefore, never applies directly to experience or to any sensuous object. Its object is, on the contrary, the understanding, to the manifold cognition of which it gives a unity a priori by means of conceptions, a unity which may be called rational unity, and which is of a nature very different from that of the unity produced by the understanding. The above is the general conception of the faculty of reason, in so far as it has been possible to make it comprehensible in the absence of examples. These will be given in the sequel. B. Of the logical use of reason. A distinction is commonly made between that which is immediately cognized and that which is inferred or concluded. That in a figure which is bounded by three straight lines there are three angles is an immediate cognition. But that these angles are together equal to two right angles is an inference or conclusion. Now, as we are constantly employing this mode of thought, and have thus become quite accustomed to it, we no longer remark the above distinction, and, as in the case of the so-called deceptions of sense, consider as immediately perceived what has really been inferred. In every reasoning or syllogism, there is a fundamental proposition, afterwards a second drawn from it, and finally the conclusion, which connects the truth in the first with the truth in the second. And that infallibly. If the judgment concluded is so contained in the first proposition that it can be deduced from it without the mediation of a third notion, the conclusion is called immediate, consequentia immediata. I prefer the term conclusion of the understanding. But if, in addition to the fundamental cognition, a second judgment is necessary for the production of the conclusion, it is called a conclusion of the reason. In the proposition, all men are mortal, are contained the propositions, some men are mortal, nothing that is not mortal is a man, and these are therefore immediate conclusions from the first. On the other hand, the proposition, all the learned are mortal, is not contained in the main proposition, for the conception of a learned man does not occur in it, and it can be deduced from the main proposition only by means of a mediating judgment. In every syllogism, I first cogitate a rule,